We listen to Ronnie. Ronnie remembers, remembers the oldies, the 50s and 60s. We listen to Ronnie. Ronnie remembers the ballads, the rock tunes, the songs we all dance to, the girl groups and boy groups, solos and doo-wop. He talks to the stars of the stage shows and sock hops. We listen to Ronnie. Ronnie remembers, remembers the oldies, the 50s and 60s.
Before bringing on our very special guest, here's a preview of what this show is all about. Record charts from A to Z. ABBA.
Mamma mia, here I go again. My, how can I resist you?
Billy Bland.
Let the little girl dance. Let the little girl dance.
Enrico Caruso.
Ah, I support her.
Doris Day.
Who's the most popular person down the tube? I can't help but think it's no one. Everybody loves me.
Duane Eddy. The Four Seasons. Marvin Gaye.
I'd be doggone if I wouldn't work all day, baby.
The Hilltoppers.
Yes, I love you.
The Isley Brothers.
It's your thing. Do what you wanna do. I can't tell you who to talk to.
Waylon Jennings.
Just a good old boy, never meaning no harm.
Carole King.
It might as well rain until September.
Frankie Lane.
My heart knows what the wild goose knows, and I must go where the wild goose goes.
The McGuire Sisters.
Sugar in the morning, sugar in the evening, sugar at supper time.
Nervous Norvis.
Eight call, Dooliaba. Eight call, Dooliaba.
The Ohio Express.
Yummy, yummy, yummy. I got love in my tummy, and I feel like I'm loving you.
Patty Page.
How much is that dog in the window?
Queen.
Mama.
The Rolling Stones. Jack Scott.
What in the world's come over you?
Tiny Tim.
Tiptoe through the window, through the window, that was our oldies.
UB40. Billy Vaughan. Mary Wells.
You wanna rock my life, someday we'll back out, baby.
XTC. Neil Young.
Searching for a heart of gold.
Lena Zavaroni. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Ronnie Allen, and it's my pleasure to introduce a superstar. Now, as far as I know, he did not sing or write any hit records. But when it comes to chronicling the record charts for the past 120 years, there is no bigger superstar in the entire world than the man I am proud to introduce right now. Ladies and gentlemen, drum roll. We have cheap drum rolls here, Joel. Mr. Joel Whitburn. Joel, thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, my pleasure, Ronnie. Good to be with you.
I let the cat out of the bag, and I told people that I was going to interview you. Do you have any questions for Joel Whitburn? And I got a ton of questions, so I have to be a little bit selective. But I want to first read you a couple of comments. A gentleman who posted on a message board, Mr. Oldies, says, please give Mr. Whitburn my regards from the Czech Republic, my admiration, many thanks for his excellent books, and my wishes of valid health. That's Mr. Oldies for you, Joel.
Very good.
Also, there's a guy named DJ, and he writes, my first wife arranged for me to pick up the 1978 singles book at his old home in Menominee Falls, Wisconsin, in December 1979. Unfortunately, Joel was not at home, but I was allowed a guided tour of some of his record collection. All I can say was, wow! Anyway, give him my best and keep the updates coming to a fellow Badger. By the way, I have one of the very first singles books published by Gale Research. What is Gale Research?
They are a company from Detroit, and they publish reference books for the library. And they found out about my very first little book, and they wanted to publish it to libraries, so I did a contract agreement with them.
And he writes, quite a contrast to my 2008 singles update. And that was signed DJ. And I'm going to read you one more, and then we'll start with the chronological order of how this monster thing called Record Research came about. And I say monster in the most complimentary of ways. BJ the DJ says, I remember his first book. It was really a thick pamphlet with a stapled binding. The title was just Record Research. I think it covered the Hot 100 charts from 1956 to 1970. It cost $50, which was a lot of money back then, but once I saw it, I couldn't live without it. A friend had bought it, and I borrowed it for several years. I still have my copy of Top Pop Records 1955 to 1972, which I sent to the bindery for a hardcover, and the 1973 to 1979 supplements, which also went to the bindery and were rebound into a single hardcover supplement. I now have more Whitburn books than I can count. Just tell him, thank you. From a long-time fan.
Wow. BJ the DJ.
BJ the DJ, yes.
Number one song in 1964.
On the country chart, yeah. Of course, that particular BJ the DJ met kind of a bad fate. But
yeah.
Different BJ the DJ.
Very nice comment.
Well, that's just for openers. A lot of people have said, was there really a Betty Crocker? Was there really a Mr. Clean? And there probably are some people who have heard your name all over the place when they hear, like, according to Whitburn, Whitburn this, Whitburn that, Whitburn books. Is there really a Joel Whitburn? And hopefully we're going to answer that question today.
I hope so.
You're playing the part pretty good so far. And I do want to apologize in advance if I don't use all of your questions. Please understand we're only doing a one-hour show today. And the website, recordresearch.com. You could check out Joel's website and find out things beyond what we're going to discuss on the show today, because we only have a limited amount of time. Just as a personal note, I actually knew you back in the 70s. I worked for Casey Kasem, American Top 40.
Mm-hmm.
And once a week, I used to call you up on the phone after I got the charts from Billboard. I had to get the advanced charts that Casey used on the show. And right after I got them from a gentleman at Billboard by the name of Mickey Addy, I would give Joel a call, and I'd say, Joel, you got a pencil, got a paper? Okay, here we go, and I'd give you the rankings. And the reason was, because as soon as I gave you the rankings, you had to go and buy every record.
That's right. Exactly.
So those are the good old days, 35 years ago.
Yeah, that was.
Unbelievable. Okay, Record Research. Where did you get the idea to do what you did? I assume it was in the 50s.
Well, I began subscribing to Billboard at the age of 14. It was like, I think it was either $12 or $15 a year. Today, that's what it costs for about one issue, I think.
Yeah.
But, you know, I happened to run across a billboard. I was at a bus station taking the bus back to Menominee Falls, and looking at the magazine stand, I saw a Billboard magazine, which I had never heard of, picked it up and started, glancing through it, And so all these full-page ads for, you know, artists like Patti Page and Frankie Lane and Johnny Ray. And, you know, I had never seen these artists. You know, you don't see them on radio. And, of course, they're not all, you know, on TV like they are today. And then the charts and the reviews of the new records coming up, I thought, this is really, really neat. So I bought a copy. And as often as I could, I tried to get another copy to find out what's going on the charts, because I didn't even realize that they had national charts at the time, you know. And I thought that was really interesting to see what was number one and what was in the top ten and so forth. So anyhow, I continued subscribing well, you know, through high school and into college. And I had accumulated these huge stacks of Billboard magazines. And when I was away at college, my mother kept them. We had this big dining room. She kept them on these tables. And many times she would ask me, can I throw those old billboards away? they're turning yellow. I said, no, don't throw them away. And, of course, then when I got married, I brought all the billboards over and stacked them all up. I had a big table down in the basement.
But at some point, you stopped merely stacking and reading them, and you decided to do something with them.
It was in 1965, Ronnie, that I got the idea to start with the very first Hot 100 chart, August of 1988. Poor Little Fool was the first number one record. In fact, that was my first card. I bought these little 3x5 cards, and I would just put Nelson, Rick, and then I would put the date, the title, and the label, and number.
I used to play around with cards, hasten at my call. But when I met that little girl, I knew that I would fall for a little fool. Oh yeah, I was a fool. Poor little fool, I was a fool all night. She'd play around and tease me with her carefree devil eyes. She'd hold me close and kiss me, but her heart was full of lies. Poor little fool, oh yeah, I was a fool,
I would keep track, you know, week by week, each position that song attained, and then I would total up the total weeks. And I was doing it as a hobby because I had this huge record collection, and I thought, you know, it'd be really interesting to know how high Chantilly Lace got on the chart. Was it number one? Did it make the top 10? Was it top 20, top 40? So as I did my research all each week by week, I would uncover these. I thought it was fascinating information. But I thought maybe I was the only one interested. I didn't know at the time there would be all these people all over the world that were interested in these chart positions. But anyhow, I accumulated this. I started in 1965 with doing the research on cards as a hobby. No way did I ever dream of it becoming a business and selling, you know, literally hundreds of thousands of books. But I pursued with the research. I was working full-time, working for RCA Records. And in the evenings, I would do my research work. And it was just a hobby. By about 1969, you know, I had a pretty good collection there going. You look up Fats Domino, you see his first record, and then you see all his two-sided hits, and you see where he was, you know, really hot with My Blue Heaven and Blueberry Hill and all those hits. And then he'd have this kind of a cold streak where he would maybe only get to, you know, 45 or 48 or something for a few releases. And then he would come back with and Jackie Wilson, you know, and Brooke Benton and all these guys. I thought it was really interesting. So I got the idea around 1969 to run a small ad in Billboard. All I could afford was just like one line of ad. And it would just say the complete Hot 100. Or you could order one artist for $1. A discography, the complete chart discography. And believe it or not, the first customer was a disc jockey from KRLA in Los Angeles called me. And his name was Casey Kasem.
Oh, gosh.
And he wanted 89 artist discographies, and he sent me a check. It was the first money I paid. It was a check for $89 from Casey Kasem. We didn't have computers and all that, so I had to type all these discographies for the cards. I would try to make carbon copies, so if somebody else wanted Fats Domino or Elvis Presley or the Everly Brothers, I would have some other copies. But you know how the carbon copies go. They get fader and fader. So I had to type those up by hand. It was still kind of a hobby.
Right.
But I thought, well, you know, this guy's a pretty big disc jockey out there in L.A. He wasn't doing the American Top 40 yet. He wanted them, so I provided them, and pretty soon I was starting to get these envelopes, you know, $5, $2, $10. People wanted these chart discographies.
Wow.
So I thought, what if I published a little book from all these cards I have in these files? You know, typed it all up, A to Z, by artist, you know, the date, the highest peak position, the week's chart, and do it all in chronological sequence. What if I published a little book? You know, how much would it cost? I didn't have the money to do it. I went to the bank here in Menomonee Falls. The vice president was a good friend of mine because I played a lot of semi-pro basketball in the area, and he used to go to my games. So he gave me the money. I needed $5,000 to print and publish my first little booklet. And he gave me the money, and so I quit my job at RCA. I went into this thing full time. I wasn't sure, but it seemed like it was a good idea. I thought, man, you know, I'm doing the Hot 100 pop charts. Maybe I could do the country charts, maybe the R&B charts, maybe the Billboard album charts. And I, you know, these thoughts are going through my mind like, wow, maybe I've got something here, you know. But I still had no idea it would take off the way it did. Not a clue.
When you put out the book, you didn't first ask permission to do it, did you?
No, I didn't. And probably luckily I didn't, because I went ahead, published the book, ran some ads in Billboard, and Hal Cook, who was a wonderful, well-respected man in the industry, he worked for Capitol, he was with Columbia, and he was a publisher for Billboard in their L.A. office. He was the head man, and he called me. Imagine, a young kid from Menomonee Falls getting a call from Hal Cook, the president and publisher of Billboard magazine. He was very friendly and said, you know, Joel, you can't use the name Hot 100. I mean, that's copyrighted. That's our name. You can't just advertise it. And he said, what exactly do you have? And I explained to him. He said, well, send me a copy. Let me look at it. So I mailed him a copy. 2 weeks later, he called again, and he said, Joel, we love the book. He said, you know, we tried doing this ourselves, and his exact words were this, everything fell through the cracks. So I don't know what that meant. I think what happened was they had this Top 100 chart, and, you know, they would just abbreviate the names, and sometimes they would make a mistake on an artist's name. You know, they'd show Ricky Nelson doing Blueberry Hill or something, you know, some crazy mistakes. And with my record collection, I was able to go through and make all the changes and decipher it all.
Now, you have just about all these records, too, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. I have one of the largest collections.
Yeah.
I thought in the state at the time, but as it grew and grew, it became one of the largest in the country. And I would use these records as the backbone of my research to check the exact title spelling, the exact name of the title.
Mm-hmm.
The exact spelling of the artist's name and any sub-name, you know, and the exact label and the exact label number, the songwriter, and the time of the record. I started entering all that information into these cards.
Now, you're talking to Hal Cook, and it wasn't just, I'm sure, the name Hot 100. I think it was the idea that you were actually using copyrighted material, their chart.
Yeah, and it's always been kind of a fine line whether that can be done or not, you know, without a license agreement. But anyhow, he invited my wife and I to come to L.A. on their expense, and they would wine and dine us, which they did. We stayed at the Beverly Hilton. He picked us up in his Mercedes. I had never been in a Mercedes. I never even saw a Mercedes. He picked us up at the airport in his car and took us up to his home in the hills there where he lived next door to,
mm-hmm.
to Tommy Smothers of the Smothers Brothers. And he was just a wonderful man. And all the people at Billboard, the chart department people, they were all fantastic. And we spent a week out there watching how they make the charts, how they publish Billboard. And we worked out a 26-page license agreement. 26 pages. And Hal Cook, Billboard, gave me the exclusive rights to mine, M-I-N-E, to mine their charts. In return, I would pay them a royalty on my book sales. They would give me free house ads, they called it house rate at the time, free advertising. They gave me a little column, the Joel Whipperin Record Research Report, that I could write and put a little coupon, which I did for several years. So, you know, I would get the advertising, I would get the exclusive rights, and in return I had to pay a pretty hefty royalty rate for my book sale.
Right.
And I thought it was a terrific idea, you know, to be able to work hand-in-hand with Billboard and to actually have an agreement with them. So we signed the agreement, and I've been the longest licensee in Billboard history now.
Wow. Well,
40 years that they keep renewing my license.
Incredible. If Hal Cook had said, no, you can't do it, end of story, there would have been no record research, there would have been no Joel Whitfern books or anything.
Right. And, you know, the last time I was in New York, John Kilcullen was the publisher, and now Howard Applebaum is the publisher, who I know very well, and he's a very nice man. And John Kilcullen, when I was in his office talking to him, this had been about 37 or 38 years that I had been their licensee, and he put his arm around me, he said, Joel, I just want to thank you for everything you've contributed to Billboard's success. And I thought that was the best compliment I ever had in my life, that they realized that my books, which really were first and foremost made for radio. I mean, I thought that was the reason I was doing it, was for disc jockeys.
For disc jockeys, yeah.
No, they have a complete history. When they're playing records, they can look up the song and the biography and know if the artist is dead or the real name or what city they're from and what their top hits were and all that. And that's who I was really selling to, disc jockeys. And they supported me tremendously at the beginning, you know. And then, of course, I guess as music fans and collectors found out about it, they wanted in on it. And what surprises me now, of course, are the orders that we get from all over the world. You know, Brazil and Argentina.
Tremendous.
And France.
We want to point out, too, that a person now can go to Barnes & Noble and buy your books, but they're not really record research books. They're actually, I'll say, the Billboard books. So maybe you could clarify that. Like, what's the difference between the books that you see on the Barnes & Noble shelf, Billboard books of this, you know, as opposed to the ones that are record research books?
Yeah, that started about 1982. It was my idea to approach Watson Guptill, who was a division of Billboard. They mainly were into art books, but they had their offices in the Billboard offices, and they were owned by Billboard. And Jules Perel was the head of it. And I called him one day and talked to him. I said, what if you guys do a spinoff on my Hot 100 book, you know, where you just do the top 40 hits?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And we could reach the mass market. And if you give me some good advertising in the book, then we can advertise our books to the mass market through that edition. He flew out here, thought it was a great idea. He kind of played the devil's advocate, like, who in the world would care if a record was number, you know, 28 or number 12? I said, well, I think a lot of people.
Yeah.
Well, and he kind of smiled and thought, well, do you think so? I said, I really do. I said, I'm shocked at how well my books are selling, you know, throughout the industry. And I said, I think if we could get a mass market book out there, you know, to the big chains, I said, I think it would be a great seller, and I think it would probably turn people on to my other books,
right,
which they were getting a good royalty on.
Sure.
So we agreed to do the first edition, the Billboard Book of Top 40 Hits,
mm-hmm.
and that was 1955 to the present, which at that time was about 1982. I was out in New York with Bill Halfway, the vice president of my company. We were visiting Billboard, and Mr. W.D. Littleford, who was the grandson of the founder of Billboard, you know, 1894, and Jules Perel took Bill and I to a wonderful place for dinner. And we sat and we talked and talked about all the ideas and about my future and so forth. And I want to tell you, Mr. Littleford was a great man, highly respected, as honest as the day is long, and I was so proud to have met him, to be with him. Anyhow, we were coming back from lunch, we were walking down, I think it was Broadway, like 47th or something, and we stopped at one of the big bookstores, and he picked up a New York Times, and the book was number 6 on their top 10 seller list.
Wow.
So we went into the bookstore, and it was one of those two-story things. You had to go up these steps, and there was a stack of our books up there. And then he looked at me, and he just grinned. Huge seller. A lot of people that bought that had turned them on to my main books, you know, because once they had the top 40, then they wanted the whole story, the whole top 100.
And then they wanted the other charts as well.
Yeah, of course. And then we did a Billboard book of R&B, we did a book of country, and we did a book on albums. They all were very, very successful. And the new edition, the 9th edition of the Top 40, should be out in the stores probably around Christmas. Now Random House owns Watson Guptill, so they'll actually say published by Random House, but we did deliver the final copy to them about a month ago. So
what does that cover, 1955 through...
55, it'll go through about July of 09. About half of the year. I think we cut off the end of July to get it to Random House.
When you go into the charts, somebody actually asked me, what do you call 2000 through 2009? Are we the
zeros?
The zeros,
yeah.
Okay, good enough. With all of the rap acts, the hip-hop acts, almost never do you see just one person's name as a credited artist. It's always this artist with this person, with that person, with this person. Doesn't that make your job difficult?
Yeah, it does. We figured out a pretty good system. If you have an artist like, say, Jay-Z and Alicia Keys, who are very hot right now,
right,
they get equal billing and they pretty much share the record 100%. So the song Empire State of Mind will get listed under each artist. But if you get, say, Drake featuring Kanye West, Lil Wayne, and Eminem, Drake will get the lead listing in our book. The other artists will be shown under a featuring heading.
Okay.
And they will only get 20% of the points instead of 100%. So, like Lil Wayne, he was the lead artist probably on, I think this year, on about 11 songs.
Right.
But he was the featured artist on about 8 or 9 more. so I can't give him full credit for all 19 or 20 songs, but I will give him credit for he's listed first and he's the lead artist. We literally treat it as like they have guest vocalists.
What I'm basically saying is once you get into the zeros, and actually it's probably started out in the 90s, it becomes a little bit more complicated than it was when records used to be by Perry Como, Frank Sinatra, Elvis Presley.
Much more complicated.
It's not that simple anymore.
All the Snoop Dogs and the Notorious B.I.G.s and all that stuff going on.
Did you ever make a record yourself? Did you ever perform, record any records?
No, I wrote a song called Wheatfield. I used to have played a little local band here. We never recorded or anything, but I played guitar and sang. And I wrote a song called Wheatfield. And it's just a real nice little kind of a death song. But anyway, I wrote it, and I used to sing it.
But that's not the one. Once there were wheat fields.
No.
Oh, look, that was the Grump side. That was Greenfield.
That's Greenfield.
Greenfield. Brothers Four. Let's go back to your first book. You told me a little secret. There's one recording. I don't know. I guess you must have dropped an index card or something. There's one recording that didn't make the first book that should have made the first book. Do you remember, Joel, what record was that you inadvertently left out of the first book?
It was Rosemary Clooney, Mongols.
If you like the way I cook, and if you like the way I look, then step inside my shady nook, and you'll find mangoes and papayas, anything your heart desires. Mangoes, papaya, chestnuts from the fire, the food is so good you will want to stay.
I remember that one. You probably did drop an index card.
Probably did.
Now, a few people have asked kind of a reverse question about this, and it's kind of a sensitive question, but I'm going to ask it because people want to know, and you could take the fifth if you want. The point has been made that what people do who compile dictionaries or maps or the type of publications that you do, they want to protect their copyright, and one of the ways they do it is put a fictitious entry, a town name that never existed, a word that never existed, a record that never existed, so that if somebody takes it out of your book, you could take them right to court and say, well, I made it up, so I know it's not true. Now, let me see. Are you going to fess up? Did you ever put a fictitious entry in any of your books to protect your copyright?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Really? Yeah, you want to give us a hint?
Well, we do it in each of our books, and generally it's just a very subtle thing. It's usually something very obscure, but we have odd people that have illegally copyrighted some of my work, and we've been able to put a stop to it. I think the first one I did was Ralph Martiri, a song called The Song of Love. I thought, now that's about as generic as you can get.
You made up the title, The Song of Love. Oh, okay.
Ralph Martiri was kind of a big band leader, and he had a couple hits, and I said, let's just throw it under Ralph Martiri. Nobody's going to suspect that he didn't have a song called The Song of Love on Mercury.
The Song of Love.
The Song of Love.
Ralph probably got a copy of your book. You know, I don't even remember recording that.
He's probably going through all his masters, you know.
We want to point out that this represents like maybe 0.001% of whatever is in your works.
Right. We do it for each of the books, and Billboard knows it, and our attorneys know it, and they've all recommend you have to do it. I mean, like you said, dictionaries do it, encyclopedias do it, and you know, the way the internet is, people just copy stuff like crazy, and we did catch a guy from Brooklyn that was counterfeiting my books.
And there it was, The Song of Love, right in there.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. We had a couple typeset mistakes in my first edition, and he copied the mistakes. You think he would have corrected, you know, where we made a song title mistake, you know.
Okay, let's get back down to earth. I'm Ronnie Allen, and I am so pleased to be doing a very unusual interview for me. This is the first time I've ever interviewed somebody who does what Joel Whitburn does. There's not that many people that do what Joel Whitburn does. And as Carly Simon would sing, nobody does it better.
Thank you.
Now, I want to point out, a few years ago, I mean, you were doing this on index cards for a period of time. I remember back in the 70s, because I'm a computer person, I used to do that as a full-time job while working for Casey part-time, and I remember talking to you on the phone one day, and I said, Joel, are you ever going to use computers? And your first answer was no. At the very beginning, you didn't want to even get involved with computers, but that changed, of course.
It certainly did. I mean, I remember, I think we invested $40,000 in our first computer in the 80s, and it was this monstrous machine with these huge discs that had to be inserted, you know, these great big heavy discs that we would insert, we'd have to back up, and I think my little iPod has probably got more power than that $40,000 computer.
How many records can you get on one of your iPods now?
I have, in fact, let me just check right at this minute.
Mm-hmm.
I have a total of, let me get it up here, 41,839 titles. That would take 98 days, 6 hours, 23 minutes, and 41 seconds to listen to. That's what it says on my screen here. 41,839 songs. Every song from about 1920 through actually next week's chart is on this computer.
This almost begs a question. We want to point out, you have somewhere around the area of 200,000 singles. Is that about fair to say that?
It's probably more than that now.
Okay. I don't want to shortchange you, Joe.
No. It's growing.
Not just merely 200,000. Do you have the time to listen to these records?
Oh, I do all the time. I don't have time to listen to the radio anymore, which is kind of sad.
Yeah.
I used to love radio. But I'm currently researching all the regional charts, all the, you know, about 25 different major markets.
Oh, wow.
And I started in 1955. I'm into 65 right now with all these wonderful garage rock bands and surf bands that were Seattle and Cleveland and Pittsburgh and those areas. And so I'm getting all that stuff. I'm going to put that in my next book. And it's real exciting because there's some great regional rock bands and doo-wop groups that came from some of these areas that never had enough strength to go nationally.
To even bubble under, perhaps.
Well, a lot of them did, but a lot of them did not even bubble under.
Yeah.
They didn't have enough strength, but they were number one, perhaps, you know, in Houston or something.
Right, and their relatives bought loads of copies of those records.
Right, so then my next book will have all that, and we're going to show the city that it came from. So
incredible.
As you're paging through the book, if you're living in Houston, book, you're going to be real excited to see these local groups that you may know, the people, you probably listened to them or bought their records, you know.
That's fantastic, and you're going to please a lot of people who say, my gosh, he remembers this one. I thought I was the only one that ever knew about this record.
Yeah, exactly. Probably got another 6 to 8 months of research on that.
You also own the largest collection of picture sleeves in the world.
Right.
And what is it, about 20,000? Something like that?
Close, yeah. I think it's more like 18,000.
Oh, okay. See, I long changed you here. 20. But it will probably eventually be 20,000 pretty soon.
It could, yeah.
How did you get all of the, I mean, there must have been some records that were extremely difficult. Once you got down to like about 20 or 30 singles that you did not have, what'd you do, a worldwide search to get those? Is that how it
worked? Well, yeah, you know, I mean, for instance, when I was trying to find every last Bubbling Under record, the Hot 100 was hard enough, finding some of those obscure things like Frankie Kaelin, Joni, and The Excellence, Coney Island Baby, and stuff like that. Those were hard to find, but we would run ads and eventually would find every one of them piece by piece. But I used to go out and buy huge collections, record shops going out of business, jukebox dealers from South Carolina that had a great rhythm and blues collection, filling my R&B archive, and we'd rent trailers, we'd haul these 100,000 or 125,000 records back, we'd sort them, get everything we need for our research, and then we'd sell the rest to collectors.
Is it true that you have every charted pop single going back to 1936?
Yes.
With the exception of The Song of Love by Ralph Martiri, that's the only one you don't have.
That's the only one, right?
I wrote down a few things here, and well, let me just put everything in perspective, and you could correct me on the numbers, Joel, because they may have been true when this was written. It said you published 122 reference books. It's probably more than that now, right?
No, that's right.
Reference
122 books.
Okay. You also are the author of the Billboard books we talked about, Watson Guptill Publications, Top 40 Hits, Top 40 Albums, Top 40 Country Hits. You also have your name on a whole boodle of these Rhino record albums, about 150 of them.
Yeah, we did a huge series with them, starting in the 80s through the 90s when CDs were really viable, you know. The Top Rock and Roll and the Top Pop Hits series, many of them, in fact, almost that whole series, that series sold a million or more. So we had a lot of gold records on that series.
Most of the Rhinos have 10 cuts on them, if I remember.
Yeah, right. They were, I guess you would consider them budget albums.
Yeah, they were budget, but they were all tied to a theme. Top movie songs, rock songs from the 70s,
yeah,
and things like that. They were tied to...
We did them, you know, year by year, top pop hit.
Some people probably thought you owned Rhino Records, because I think that at least half of the things that Rhino puts out are Joel Whitburn.
Well, you know, that's another thing, like I did with Jules Perel of Watson Guptill. I called Richard Foos, who was the president of Rhino Records in L.A. They were putting out a lot of Dr. Demento-type novelty things, and some really weird stuff, and I suggested, why don't we do a series in the top 10 hits year by year, based on my chart research. And he said, let's try five volumes, 55 through 59.
Right.
We'll do the top 10 hits of each year. So I would send him my list of what I thought were the top 10, and then I would have to give him alternates because, you know, there were some things he couldn't license for whatever reason. They needed alternates, and then we would end up with still a really good top 10 hits from each year. And, of course, it took off. It sold like crazy, and he'd call me almost every week, Joel, let's do five more years. Let's do country. Let's do this. Let's do that, you know.
Right.
And I was working almost full-time there for a couple of years for Rhino, it seemed, you know, putting together these compilations. They were selling like crazy.
Yeah. You do have a staff.
Yeah.
And how many people are on your staff right now?
Five full-time and two part-time.
Any openings? Can I volunteer?
Well, it's kind of a long commute, I think.
Well, I don't care. Can I relocate?
Yeah.
I have an interesting question, B-U-O-N-G-E, Buonji, I believe, or Bonji. And he brought up a question that I'm kind of curious about as well. Back in the 50s, Billboard had several different charts. They had a bestseller chart, they had a jukebox chart, they had a jockey chart, which was most played by DJs, and they had a top 100 chart, which predated the Hot 100. But getting to the bestsellers, how could a record, like one example that I looked at this morning was a record by the Four Lads. They had A Paper of Pins was on one side, and A House with Love in It was on the other side, and one of them ranked like at a high of number 22, and the other got a high of 26. If you went into a record shop, if you bought one side of the record, you buy both sides of the record. So how could Billboard separate which side was selling?
Well, there's many ways. First of all, on the bestseller chart, you got to remember that singles were kept behind the counter. They weren't out where you could just grab them, you know, because of theft. Albums were out, but singles were generally in big kind of racks behind the counter. And a person would come in and ask, you know, I want A House with Love in It. Well, they kept little diaries. They kept little notes. And after you leave, they would jot down Four Lads, and they would report those findings to Billboard. All the major record shops from around the country reported, would read their diaries.
Oh, I see.
To
but
Billboard, and then they would compile it from that.
All right, now I grew up in Teaneck, New Jersey, and I remember the Teaneck record shop was a little bit different. They actually did have the singles on the shelf, so some record shops...
I remember the ones I went to, you know, in the 50s and 60s. I mean, you'd go to the counter, they'd have the charts sitting there under glass or something. You'd say, you know, I'd like this, that, and they'd pull them out, and you'd look at them. Sometimes they'd put them back, you'd want something else. But it wasn't until, oh, I don't know when, I think there was a W.T. Grant store came by, and they had a big 45 collection that they had in racks out in the store, and I thought that was really neat. There were some stores that would even let you play the record, you know, which isn't too cool because, you know, they didn't have the best record players and the best styluses to play these things.
For the two or three people out there that may have never seen a Joel Whitburn book, basically every Joel Whitburn book for every single song title, whether it's a pop music book or a country or rhythm and blues or albums, it basically has the same format. You have the song title, you have the record artist, you have each record's peak position, the date charted, which sometimes Casey Kasem would call a debut date. The date charted means the first week that it was on the chart. Weeks charted, the label, and the stock number. And in the later editions, now this was not true of the earlier editions. The first one didn't have any trivia at all. It just had the titles and the artist, obviously. But everything after the earliest editions have trivia on recordings and artists, talking about biographical information and history, when they were in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and, you know, that sort of stuff. Is that a pretty good synopsis of what people who have never seen your books are going to find?
Yeah, very good. The reason we put these thumbnail biographies in is because, again, we started doing it for disc jockeys, so if you look up Little Anthony, you would find out his real name is Anthony Gradine, and that he was born on January 8th of 1940, and who the other members of the group were.
Yeah.
And that was real quick. You could just grab that, and like Tears on My Pillow, we put a note in. It was first released on the end label as simply by the Imperials.
Right.
Another little note. They did a song called My Empty Room. That's the same melody as the Platters Wear in the Steve Lawrence song In Time. And so we started putting in these trivia notes, and our customers said they loved them, and they said, you know, give us more and more and more. So the more little facts and interesting little things we could find out about, you know, what movie it was from or TV or show or whatever, we would put all the information we could find about the artist and the song title.
It just continued to grow. And, of course, even back in the early days, you had some complications. Freddie Cannon couldn't decide how to spell his first name. It was either Freddie, you know, F-R-E-D-D-Y, or Freddie, F-R-E-D-D-I-E on some records. And also, some records would even change their title in the middle of the chart run. By Clarence Frogman Henry became But I Do.
Yeah, the first pressing of Will You Love Me Tomorrow was simply Tomorrow on the Scepter label.
That's right. And
things like that.
I have to ask you now, in your personal opinion, what's the worst record ever made?
That's pretty easy for me. It was a record I bought back in 1953. It had a picture sleeve. I think that's the reason I bought it, because in 53 there were very few records. It was Wally Cox. Remember Mr. Peepers?
Oh, yes.
He did a song called There Is a Tavern in the Town. Or at least he tried doing it.
Yeah.
It was so bad I had to put it in. I showed 1953 / worst record in history. Every other record has a peak position or something. That's the only one that says worst record in history.
But it actually charted.
Well, it did, yeah, in 53. Probably because of the picture sleeve.
Yeah, and in fact, the flip side charted too, which was Dufo, What a Crazy Guy.
Yeah, that it was a two-sided thing. But
now, There Is a Tavern in the Town. That's a song that had been around a long time. Other people had done it. But it was the way Wally Cox did it.
Yeah.
That was annoying to people, right?
Do you have the song?
I will make sure that I have it.
If you don't, I've got it right here. I can play it. But
oh, you want to? How quickly can you bring it up? Can you
I can play it right now.
Okay, let me hear you do this.
Play just a little bit of it here.
Okay.
Oh, there's a tavern in the town, in the town. And there, my true love sits them down, and he drinks his wine as merry as can be. And never, 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 never thinks of me.
Oh,
gone,
my God.
Gone, gone, gone.
Did you believe that?
Oh, gee, Wally, I'm so sorry. Chuck, I'm doing my best Chuck Barris, which isn't too good.
I can't imagine any song ever made.
No, wait.
It's worse.
Wait a minute. Let me submit this one by the legendary Stardust Cowboy.
Hey, yeah! Yes, yeah! Yes, it's in that bougie now, man! Yeah! yourself, to yourself. Bugs makes fun of yourself, girl.
Are you going to tell me a Wally Cox was worse than that one?
Yes.
Okay.
I think so. At least in my book it is.
Well, Wally is not around to defend himself right now.
I know there's a guy in our local radio here at the biggest station in town, and he claims that Vito and the Salutations, Unchained Melody, he said is the worst ever.
Bo, 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 bo.
And there are some people that think that is one of the best examples of fast doo-wop ever. So
yeah.
There's an old expression, one man's meat is another man's poison.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
a matter
maybe,
of different strokes.
People like this Wally Cox is yodeling or whatever it is he's doing.
Oh, oh, oh. Moving right along. A few people wanted me to ask you this question about a lot of the times when you do rankings in your books, like overall rankings, you rank all records that have been number one, and the weakest number one falls ahead of the strongest number two, and they're wondering why you did that kind of a system instead of an inverse point system, where it would be possible for a number two record to be overall higher than number one.
No, I don't like that at all. I don't think a number two record should ever be rated over a number one record. The whole idea behind making the charts is to try to get to number one. It'd be like ranking, you know, an NFL team that didn't win the Super Bowl, but it had such a great record. It's really the best team of the year. Forget what happened in the Super Bowl, or forget what happened in the World Series. You know, the Phillies really were the best team, so we're not even going to think about it. It's the same way with the charts. If you get to number one, I mean, you're number one in the United States over everything. And no number two record, you know, if it lingers on the charts and it gains a lot of points, and a lot of these records did straggle in
right.
the 20s and the 30s. Sometimes a record does not go number one right out of the box. It'll, you know, like the Beatles yesterday, I mean, 2 weeks, number one. And Can't Buy Me Love, you know, the second week it was number one, and
yeah.
11 weeks it's off the charts because it just swept the nation like crazy, you know, and then they came up with another song, and that went up, and the other one went off.
Right.
So a song like Yesterday or Can't Buy Me Love would probably be ranked pretty low if you went by the weeks charted and the number of points it would
right.
gain. And I don't like that. I know Billboard does it that way for their year-end rankings, but I never liked it before I even started my job. I used to see those and think, oh, man, they're showing, you know,
yeah.
a song they got to number three or four, they're showing that as the
right.
second biggest record of the year.
Yeah, yeah,
that
right.
doesn't...
Playing the devil's advocate, though, some people might point out that a record by Foreigner, which stayed at number two for 10 weeks in a row, probably sold more copies and probably was a bigger record than, let's say, Whatever Gets You Through the Night, which was a John Lennon record that made number one but was one of the weaker number ones. So some people might argue that some number two records that were number two almost forever, probably because they were in back of a number one record that happened to be stronger. You may have had a week where you had two records, each of which would have been strong enough to be number one, but there could only be one number one. So some people might differ with you on that.
Well, people do. I mean, a lot of people have their own way. I mean, I had a guy once send me a whole page of a mathematical solution to this. It was so complicated, it actually went into a second page. I just laughed at it. I mean, it's ridiculous.
No.
Then you got to try to explain it to somebody, how we came up with this ranking, this long, long, complicated mathematical thing. Forget it.
Yeah.
If the record goes to number one and it peaks at number one for 7 weeks, and there's one at 6 weeks, that's your number one and two record. And if it's number two for 10 weeks, then it's the biggest number two record of the year.
It's certainly easier to calculate it that way, certainly.
It is, and it's very simple for people to see and to understand it, and that's the way my book, The Pop Annual, ranks every record from number one through 100.
Now, many people not only say that Joel Whitburn is the guru and say that Billboard is the Bible, very often on the internet all over the place, people will say this record made number five in Billboard or number five on the Billboard Hot 100. Can people do that legally, or is that a sticky area? Not listing an entire chart, but just saying, oh, I recorded this record and it got to number five in Billboard. Is that okay?
Yeah, no problem.
No problem with that. But if you said, here's the entire Billboard Hot 100 page for that week, then that might be a stickier issue.
That's a problem.
Okay. Back in the 50s, it was not that simple, as I mentioned. You had various charts, and you assigned the peak position to the highest position reached on any one of those charts.
Exactly.
Didn't that occasionally result in kind of a false peak if, for example, one record happened to be incredibly popular as a jockey record, but didn't do well on the other charts, but it would still, you know, benefit and get that highest position?
Well, there was no single chart like a Hot 100 that incorporated everything into one.
Right.
So you had to look at the disc jockey chart, which meant a lot, what was being played on the radio coast to coast. You had to look at the jukebox charts. I mean, jukebox sales were incredible. I think over 60% of the record sales were by jukebox operators from 58 to about 63. Think of that. They would go into these one-stops, and they would buy literally boxes and boxes, you know, sometimes seven or eight
boxes.
Was that
because there were that many jukeboxes?
Are you kidding? Jukeboxes were
I mean, there were hundreds of thousands of jukeboxes?
Yes.
Yeah, I wasn't.
Yes, every place you went, there were jukeboxes, and they were getting incredible amount of plays. And the sales to jukebox dealers was incredible. The singles industry was just booming. It was more of a singles industry than it was an album industry back at the beginning of rock and roll. I mean, you think of the first Chuck Berry albums, they never even charted. Same with Little Richard and Fats Domino and all those artists.
And a lot of artists that were putting out records then that had, like, this record plus 10 others. That's what the album would be called. This plus 11 others or whatever.
Right.
I'm Ronnie. We're kind of winding down, but I have a few more quick questions for Mr. Whitburn. And I'm going to play a little excerpt from this particular record, which I understand was the highest priced charting record.
Surfing is the only life, the only way for me now. Surf with ball, dip, dip. I got up this morning, turned on my radio. I was checking out the surfing scene to see if I would go. And when the DJ tells me that the surfing is fine, that's when I know my baby and I will have a good time. Go with surf, ball, dip, dip, ball, dip, dip. Surfing is the only life, the only way for me now. Surf with from the early morning to the middle of the night. Anytime the surf is up, the time is right. And when the surf is down to take its place, we'll do the surfer stomp, it's
a That was the Beach Boys and Surfin'. That's before they got to do their other surfing records. That was on the Candix record label, C-A-N-D-I-X. You do have some price lists in some of your books, and that, I think, was the most valuable.
$125.
Yeah, we priced records for, I don't know, about four or five editions. But what happened, Ronnie, is the internet came into play with eBay, and we found out that one guy was selling a record for $2, another guy was selling the same one for $25, in the same condition and everything. You'd go to a place like Gem or eBay, and there may be a whole page for sale, and the prices are all over the place. So we just dropped it. We just dropped showing the prices because it just seemed like people would pay whatever market
That's
they wanted,
true.
Or whatever, you know.
And, of course, the conditions of the records were very important.
Yeah, and if it had a picture sleeve, and if it had a color vinyl, something like that, you know, there was all these, you know, and then there was the error records and the mistake records, and the B-sides were different.
Oh, yeah.
So there are price guides out there, the really good price guides.
Right. But I did want to point out that that Beach Boys record, at least at the time you did one of the editions, was the most valuable.
Yeah, it was. I think today that if you could find one in really clean, you know, near mint, it would probably be worth a couple hundred.
Wasn't a bad record either.
It was a good record.
It was a darn good record. It should have been as big as Surfing USA.
It was an excellent record. It just was such a small little West Coast label.
And what's more, they didn't plagiarize Chuck Berry on that one either, like they did with Surfing USA.
That's right. Yeah, exactly.
And Chuck got his name on Surfing USA, by the way.
He sure did.
I want to point out. Now, SoundScan has changed the business in so many respects, and I have a question. Back in the old days, when the album charts were done, it was pretty predictable. Records did not generally debut it, and in fact, they didn't debut at number one in the album chart back in the old days, and they would move up the chart, they would achieve a certain peak position, they might hold for a couple of weeks, and then they would move down, but it was very predictable. And nowadays, it's predictable in a different way. With SoundScan, it's a regular occurrence, rather than the exception, that records debut at number one, right? Out of the box, boom. So my question is, were the old charting methods not correct? Because there's so much of a difference between what you see today and what you saw back in the 60s. Is it that the business changed, or the charts changed, or if SoundScan had been available back then, might the album charts have been different back then?
Well, back then, you know, a lot of information was mailed to the Billboard office, the playlist. A lot of it was done over the phone, but a lot of radio stations in small suburban, in small areas, rural areas and that, would mail in their diaries, their playlists and so forth, record shops and all that. So compiling the data was usually a little behind. If they said, you know, this is for the November 21st issue, it may have been data that was actually accumulated, say, a week and a half, maybe 2 weeks earlier.
So there'd be a lag time.
Yeah, but today, I mean, you know, the airplay is monitored by Nielsen Broadcast Data Systems, and then you got sales data compiled by SoundScan. So between the BDS monitoring and the sales data being monitored on an instant basis electronically to Billboard, the whole wall of information from New York to L.A. is there in an instant.
Right. I assume that had that been available back in the days of the Beatles' heyday, that several of the Beatles' albums would have probably debuted.
Right. Instead of, you know, taking 2 weeks or 3 weeks to go
number one,
they
would have
gone
just
number
boom.
One the first week. Absolutely.
And the other thing is that the Hot 100 combined airplay and sales, but you were not eligible if a record was not out. Billboard, for a while, only allowed records that were available as singles to be on the Hot 100.
Yes.
Now, the problem with that was that record companies were able to manipulate the charts a bit. You have a record that's getting a certain amount of airplay, and it gets airplay like for like 8 or 9 weeks. And during that time, that record would have been moving up the Hot 100 gradually if it had been allowed to be on the Hot 100. And then, all of a sudden, they put it out as a single, and bingo, it debuts at number one, because this is the first week that it's allowed to be on the chart.
Record labels have always found ways to play games like that. You know what I mean by playing games? They know the methodology of how the charts are compiled. They know the dates that are covered. And, you know, that's exactly why new releases come on Tuesday, because that's the start of a new chart week.
They know what they have to do.
So Tuesday morning, all these new things hit the charts, and by the time that information is tabulated, you know, the chart will come out the next week. It'll show a record at number one, like just instant. But they've always done things, giving away records free or, you know, some new release, putting a low price on it so it'll get a lot of sales and it'll probably come out with a...
But my point is simply this. If the chart methodology had been different and then they had allowed the airplay, that kind of manipulation would not have been possible, obviously.
Not as much.
Not as
but they always find ways.
Yeah.
They're always looking for ways.
Yeah.
They're very clever. And Billboard is up to the task because they're always finding ways to defeat anything that the record companies come up with.
A record like Yesterday by the Beatles was only on the chart for, what, 10 or 11 weeks.
Right, and all those records were just out of the box.
Yeah, because once a record got to drop down to number 25, they just dropped it off the chart the following week. That has changed, and now these days you could have a Leanne Rimes record on the chart for over 60 weeks that doesn't even make number one. Got to number two, I think, How Do I Live.
Well, they dropped songs off the charts after it goes below number 50. If on the chart at least 20 weeks.
Yeah.
But a song like Leanne Rimes stayed in the top 20 and top 30 for forever.
Oh, she was, it was incredible. But then again, you had the airplay factor, too, and things do change. We want to repeat that the website address for information about all of the books that Joel is selling right now, www.recordresearch, recordresearch.com, and that'll give you all the information of what's currently out there and also a sneak preview of what's to come in the future.
Yes, our 40th anniversary, so we've got a big, huge sale going on then.
Well, you know, I wanted to wait until it was your 40th anniversary before we did this show. So I timed it beautifully, and it'll be a great Christmas gift. Is the book going to be out by Christmas, or you're not sure?
Which one?
The new one.
The Top Off Sales?
Yeah.
Is out.
It is out.
It's in stock.
Because I think you said like around Christmas time was going to be out, and then maybe I misunderstood you. It is out.
No, that was a Top 40 book.
Okay, is that a new, the different one?
The Random House book will be out around Christmas.
Okay.
My book, the Top Pop Singles, is in stock. We've had it for about 3 weeks now.
Okay. This has just been an incredible experience for me. I thank you so much for taking the time and giving us a glimpse of what your very unusual and extremely productive life has been like.
Well, I appreciate your call. It's always good to talk to you, and I enjoy talking about the music industry and the charts and the records. It's been my life.
My last question is, if you had it to do all over, would you do anything differently in terms of major decisions, or did things just work out?
No, I wouldn't. I'd do the same thing all over again.
And with that, we shall close. Joel, I want to wish you happy Thanksgiving, first of all. That's coming up next week. And the Christmas holidays as well. And a wonderful new year to you, your family, and your associates.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much, Ronnie. And I wish the same for you and your family and all your loved ones.
Thanks a million, Joel, and all the best to you.
Thanks
and
to all your fans and listeners. So many of them have been great supporters of my work. I love them all.
Just keep them coming, because, Joel, I cannot, as I look back, I just cannot imagine what the music world would have been like without your books.
Well, I guess there was a purpose.
There was, Joel, and hopefully we'll talk again soon.
Okay, Ronnie.
Thank you so much.
We listen to Ronnie. Ronnie remembers. Remember the oldies, the 50s and 60s.